Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Michael Ruppert returns with a lucid account of peak oil and why the world's declining oil reserves are an even bigger problem than some think. Even so, Ruppert remains an optimist. Sort of. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, we heard from Michael Ruppert on the coming collapse and how to survive it. It's from a 2009 film about Ruppert called Collapse. The film takes a complex and somewhat critical view of Ruppert. Like all prophets, he comes across as quirky. Even so, Ruppert's discussion of peak oil and its consequences strikes me as very sound indeed. Film critic Roger Ebert thought so too. He gave the film 4 stars, and he too focused on peak oil. I'll read parts of his review, lightly edited for radio. Ebert writes, "I can't promise you that the bleak version of the future in this movie is accurate. I can only tell you that I have a pretty good built-in BS detector, and its needle never bounced off zero while I watched this film." Ruppert has many critics, but one simple fact at the center of his argument is obviously true, and it terrifies me. We have passed the peak of global oil resources. There are only so many known oil reserves. We have used up more than half of them. Remaining reserves are growing smaller, and the demand is growing larger. You do the math. We will soon face a global oil crisis. Many people now alive may well see a world without significant oil. As Michael Ruppert notes, many things are made from oil. Everything plastic. Paint. There are 8 gallons of oil in every auto tire. More oil supplies the energy to convert oil into these byproducts. No oil, no plastic, no tires. No gas to run cars, no machines to build cars, no coal mines, except those operated by men and horses. Roger Ebert continues, "For Ruppert, oil is the key to understanding many geopolitical events. It explains why Bush-Cheney invaded Iraq, and why our embassy compound in Baghdad is the largest we've ever built, larger than all of Vatican City. And why we're more worried by Iran than North Korea. It may also explain Obama's perplexing decision to increase troops in Afghanistan. An undeclared world war for oil is already underway. I don't know when I've seen a thriller more frightening. I couldn't tear my eyes from the screen. I think you owe it to yourself to see it." So said Roger Ebert in December 2009. Well, like most documentaries, the movie played in a few theaters, and very few people saw it. Well, you got to hear some of it last week, and let's hear some more now. From Chris Smith's 2009 film Collapse, here is Michael Ruppert on peak oil.
I first became focused on energy issues in late 2001, just maybe a month or two after 9/11. I was contacted by a geologist, a brilliant guy named Dale Allen Pfeiffer, who introduced me to the concept of peak oil and the basic issues about energy and helped me to realize that there was a great deal of evidence in 2001, not only that peak oil was very real, but that government agencies were acting and responding as if it was very real. All plastic is oil. Most paints, all pesticides are made from oil. Everything from toothpaste to toothbrushes is made from oil. There are 7 gallons of oil in every tire. There is nothing anywhere in any combination that will replace the edifice built by fossil fuels. Nothing. Well, peak oil is probably now very easy to explain, much easier than it was a long time ago. People have felt what $147 a barrel oil feels like. Essentially, peak oil is like if you know what a bell curve is. Goes up, comes down. Peak oil is the point of oil production when you're at the top of the bell curve. And essentially what that means is you've used up half of the resource. But in the case of oil or any other substance like that, no matter how much money you throw at it, you're never going to be able to increase oil production above where it was at peak. As of 2008, the International Energy Agency has admitted that there is a global 9% decline rate in oil production. That's the equivalent of about 8 million barrels a day. There is no way, having plucked all the low-hanging fruit and found the big reservoirs, that we're going to be able to offset a 9% decline rate. From a detective standpoint, if you're trying to assemble a case, the multidimensional aspects of a case, means, motive, opportunity, to understand what kind of force drives events. Peak oil was almost with the stroke of like a diamond cutter's knife, the single piece which started to make everything resonate and make sense together. You will recall that when the Bush administration took office in January 2001, a National Energy Policy Development Group, the NEPDG, was formed and placed under the exclusive, private, absolute control of Vice President Dick Cheney. Its records were kept a secret. Its minutes were kept a secret. 7 pages were released as a result of 2 lawsuits. And it clearly shows that that task force was looking, saying, how much oil is there? Where is it? Who owns it? They knew that this was coming for a long time. It's been known that this event, this collapse, this crash was coming.
Who they were, we can't even get information as to who was involved and what they were.
First of all, if you think there might be oil someplace, then what you do is you go drill a test well. Then what you have to do is to take that one well in the center and then you drill a series of appraisal wells around that well to determine where the oil field might go. You don't know how much oil you're going to get, how deep it is, what kind of oil it's going to be. There are many different grades of oils, a lot of which are more expensive to refine. So all of that has to do with how long it takes to make something produce. How much energy do you get back for how much energy you invested? When oil was seeping out of the ground in Pennsylvania, you got a return of, 200 to 1. When you have to go offshore to deep water, drilling in 15,000 feet of water, and your first well costs $150 million to build, all that's energy that's being invested to get energy. And the moment you start burning more energy to get a barrel of oil out of the ground than it's worth, forget about it. The world's been thoroughly explored over the last 120 years. There's no new major oil finds left. As a matter of fact, no field the size of Ghawar, the largest field in Saudi Arabia, has ever been discovered since. Saudi Arabia has 25% of the known oil reserves on the planet. 25%. Why, if Saudi Arabia has all these untapped reserves onshore, are they moving heavily into offshore drilling? Now, if it's 5, 10, 50 times more expensive to drill offshore than on land, doesn't that tell you that Saudi Arabia knows they've got no more oil to find? It's axiomatic that if Saudi Arabia has passed its peak and is in decline, the whole planet is, just because of the size of the reserves that are there. Iraq is oil that's not only accessible, it's right close to the Persian Gulf, which means it's a short distance to ships. They can put the pipelines, they can get that into the global supply stream as everything else declines. And Iraq was all about the oil. You know, a lot of people have admitted that, and like, duh. 11 days after 9/11, when there was no clear evidence that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11, of course he didn't, that the plans were started to invade Iraq, of course. That was the objective. Get control of that oil. Because Saddam Hussein had been talking about pricing his oil in euros, taking it away from the dollar. We got in there, we restructured everything, we put in a friendly government using the U.S. dollar, and we assured the oil companies their quote-unquote fair access and fair share of Iraqi oil.
The international oil companies into Iraqi oil fields.
We have no intention of leaving Iraq. We're never going to leave Iraq. Going back to 2004, we started building the largest, most permanent military bases, three of them in the world, plus the largest embassy compound that's ever been built. We built an embassy compound in Baghdad that's bigger than Vatican City. That's not a temporary deal. Nobody's going to take that oil, but we are sitting on it. But there is not enough oil in Iraq to change anything. But Iraq probably has around 90 billion barrels of recoverable oil. That sounds like a lot of oil. But when you consider that in 2008, the world was consuming 85 million barrels a day, that means a billion barrels of oil only lasts for about 11 and a half days. So that ain't that much oil.
It's only the first of the good things that will happen to Iraq, thanks to oil.
They knew exactly what was coming. That's what's in the National Energy Policy Development Group report that's been classified, because if that report were declassified, we would be building scaffolds to hang Dick Cheney and everybody in that administration tomorrow. Let's assume, just for the sake of discussion, that there's 600 billion barrels in the Arctic. First of all, it happens to be under the polar ice cap. That's a problem. The polar ice cap happens to be on, 10, 15,000 feet of water. The problem with the polar ice cap is it floats. It moves. So you can't drill a well on Tuesday and expect it to be in the same place on Thursday. That's why a lot of conservative think tanks and oil companies are cheering the melting of the polar ice caps.
Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR.
Developing this tiny section of ANWR.
If there is oil in ANWR, there's no more than about a six-month supply for the entire United States. There are no pipelines across 1,000 miles of tundra that's melting due to global warming, which means you can't sink pipes to support a pipeline in tundra that's turned to mud. There's no tanker routes. The wells aren't drilled, and yet we are spending our future as if that oil is there. We got to drop all this lying right now. We don't need transparency about anything other than how much oil is really left, because we don't know. Oil is a commodity. It's an asset. You make loans based upon what's in the ground. So you have all these accounting terms: possible reserves, proven reserves, ultimately recoverable reserves, verified reserves, estimated. But actual reserve estimates are state secrets. The Saudis don't dare announce that they've passed their peak of oil production. Why? They have a very restive population that have been sold an expectation of a rising standard of living. And the moment Saudi Arabia acknowledges it's past peak, it may well have a revolution. Now, what happens if there's a revolution in Saudi Arabia with 25% of the world's known oil? Where's that oil going to get replaced from? It can't be. Very complex problem. It's a very complex situation.
Just start working now, otherwise we won't have time. We're going to be out of oil within a few years.
In doing this sort of pulling archival footage for this film, I found at least 10 examples of people in the late 70s talking about this is the end of oil. This is like end of a way of life. We're hitting a new era.
This situation is destined to continue.
People look at that footage and I think that they can feel that it's somewhat alarmist, given that we were able to continue to our way of life for another 30, 35 years. Do you see any parallels between that time and now?
The 70s was really a critical decade. In the 70s, Marion King Hubbert, the original prophet of peak oil, in late 1949, he did the math that said U.S. domestic oil production will peak in 1970. So that's not some feat of Nostradamus communicating with some entity. It's math. It's science. It's simple. But in the 70s, M. King Hubbert testified before Congress. That was 1974. In 1976, President Jimmy Carter said, man, we cannot use as much energy as we have been using.
To use energy more efficiently.
That's when solar panels went up. That's when he started. He knew. They have known in Washington. I have published on my website, as have others, declassified CIA documents from 1976 showing that CIA was perfectly aware of peak oil. In those days, of course, when the situation appeared to be normal, when people had jobs, they had vacations, they had credit cards, they had credit lines, everybody's talking about growth, 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 buy, 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 spend, consume, consume, and everything seemed to be working. Yeah, we were called alarmists. We don't live in that world anymore.
Americans were on the way to owning millions of cars.
$800 million internal combustion-powered vehicles on the planet. They all run on oil. It takes uncounted barrels of oil to make those cars and engines in the first place. And you cannot plug any new technology into an internal combustion-powered engine. With 7 gallons of oil in every tire, nobody will ever make 800 million new internal combustion anything because there ain't going to be enough oil. Ethanol is an absolute joke. First of all, a very brilliant scientist, David Pimentel, took the concept of net energy. How much energy do you invest versus how much do you get in return? And he concluded about a decade ago, I guess, that it takes more energy to make ethanol than you get from burning it, which is absolute stupidity. Because you drive the oil-powered machines, et cetera, you irrigate, you use the fertilizers, you're burning all that oil and natural gas to grow it. Then you make steam, which is more hydrocarbon energy, you add more chemicals, and you come up with ethanol, which you can put in a car. Now, the Bush administration had announced a goal of having 15% of all fuel in the United States made from ethanol, I think, by the year 2015. They forgot to tell you that that would take all the arable land used to grow corn to do it. Canadian tar sands is an oil. It is a very, very thick, sticky, obnoxious substance that's mixed in with sand at levels 200, 300, 400, 500 feet in layers beneath the soil. This is in Alberta. And they literally strip mine thousands of tons a day. They put them in these huge oil-powered dump trucks and drive them to a place where they then wash the sand. They take millions and billions of gallons of fresh water, which we're running out of everywhere, and they boil it by burning natural gas. There is not a possibility anywhere. The Canadian tar sands production will exceed maybe 3.5 million barrels a day. The first thing that the uneducated mind that's in denial says, well, what about hydrogen? Can't we make electric cars? And I have to bring them back to the fact that there's 7 gallons of oil in every tire, that there are thousands of gallons of oil in every car, in the plastics, the paints, the resins, everything. All of that's made by oil, the oil that's used to manufacture the car and ship it around to heat the metals, et cetera, et cetera. There will never be 800 million electric-powered vehicles, and electricity is not an energy source. The electricity is generated by burning or using some other kind of energy. It's clear that electricity is the key to industrial civilization in that it powers our refrigeration. It runs the water pumps that pump water out of the New York subway system every day. It allows us to commute electronically, charge our cell phone batteries, preserve food, run operating rooms, etc. The subject of alternative energies. There is no such thing as clean coal, and there never, ever will be. Why? Carbon sequestration is enormously expensive. What it says is essentially is you capture the CO2 and any other greenhouse gases emitted in the burning of the coal. You exert enormous amounts of energy to compress it. Then you move it over enormously long distances, and you pump it into some airtight chamber in the ground where somebody will figure out with technology what to do with the greenhouse gas in 10 or 15,000 years. Nuclear process requires something like 10 to 13 years of incubation to get the permitting done, all the regulations satisfied, and the construction of nuclear power plants is one of the most energy-intensive processes in the world. The steel, the lead containment, the enrichment of uranium is a horribly intensive process. You just don't throw a rock of uranium in and start making nuclear energy. Can't do that. The first and obvious problem with tidal energy is that it has to be generated or collected near a coastline. Salt water is extremely corrosive. There's an enormous net energy cost in manufacturing the machines. There are only two alternative energies which can really have an immediate impact, an immediate benefit. Now, the problem with plans like enormous wind farms in Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, the fundamental law with electricity is that it's drawn off right where it's used first. Yes, you can transmit electricity over long distances, but people don't think about the energy that goes into transformers and how much copper is in power lines and all the maintenance that has to go to that grid. So when you see really ridiculous commercials that say we could have a solar array 96 miles in the desert, they don't even think about the fact that that electricity is going to get used in California before it goes anyplace else. The soil is the place from which all plant matter gets its nutrients. And if you keep sucking the nutrients out, the soil is useless. For all of history, the way the soil was replenished, and the nutrients were returned in some measure to the soil, was that plant matter was allowed to decay, to compost, to restock the soil. That's why crop rotation is so important. You may have one crop of celery which will suck certain chemicals out of the soil. Another crop, wheat or something else, may return those same chemicals to the soil. So the soil maintains a balance. It's kind of sad because we as a species have become so disconnected from the earth. We don't have any real contact with the earth. We don't have any sense of its functions, its feel, its nature, its seasons, its timing. First of all, the topsoil on which food is grown now is nothing more than a sponge onto which we pour chemicals that we get from oil and natural gas. And without those chemicals, the soil has been turned into a junkie. The soil is worthless. So when you plant a crop now, what happens is you drive an oil-powered machine, drives along, and it plows. Then you drive another oil-powered machine, and it drives along, and it plants. And then you irrigate. Well, how do you irrigate? Well, that water is pumped by pumps that are powered by electricity. Where does that electricity come from? In the United States, it's either coal or natural gas. So next thing you do is come along and you fertilize it. All commercial fertilizers are made from ammonia, and the feedstock for ammonia is natural gas. So you have ammonium nitrate fertilizers that are then sprayed on by another oil-powered vehicle. Then the crop dusters come along that are powered by oil that spray pesticides that are all made from petroleum. Then when it's time to harvest the food, what do? You drive another oil-powered machine and you harvest it. You use another oil-powered machine to drive it to a place where it's processed. Then you wrap it up in plastic, which is oil, and you put it in another oil-powered machine, and you drive it X number of miles to a food distribution warehouse, an oil-powered machine to your supermarket. The way food is grown, produced, and moved around the world today, it's an enormous waste of hydrocarbon energy, which doesn't make sense. Why do we have strawberries from Chile? Why do we have spinach from China? Why do we ship anchovies halfway around the world to be packaged in tin cans and, you know? There are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food consumed in the industrialized world. The only thing in the world that you and I can possibly change to give ourselves a chance of survival and to give our children a chance at some kind of human, civilized life is our minds. You have to believe not wish, not hope, not pray, not beg. You just have to believe that there's a way out of it, and you're going to find it. This is perhaps the greatest part of the American character, is when we get and we put our minds to something and we clearly understand what needs to be done and we believe in it, we really can change things. I plan on living joyfully and happily for the rest of my life, a free man. How can you possibly say there's no hope? Just change your mind and see what we see. Stop thinking like dinosaurs.
Michael Ruppert, ending on a surprisingly upbeat note. Before that, a good survey of the peak oil problem, and a reminder that there's no alternative fuel that we can just substitute, and a survey of all the things that depend on oil, including corporate factory farms. This is me speaking, not Ruppert, but I think we have a somewhat workable alternative to both energy and food, and that is small scale and local and organic and solar. If we have to turn off a few streetlights and live without Las Vegas and Disney World, sounds okay to me. If the Amish can do it and the Cubans can do it, the only reason we can't do it would be corporate greed. Well, maybe it's time the citizens controlled the corporations instead of vice versa. Alas, we don't have time to play Dancing in the Ruins, so I guess we'll go out on Werewolves of London as usual. Thank you for listening. Check out our archive of shows at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Next week, a special program of comic satire for Christmas. Until then, from Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, try to speak the truth, and please tune in again. Ciao.